From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina's Certificate of Need represents one way government restricts healthcare innovation. We'll chat with a lawyer challenging that certificate process and other government interventions in healthcare. Some state lawmakers are pushing Allison's Law. It would allow new tracking of violent domestic abuse offenders. A recent report focuses on improving early childhood learning in North Carolina's most challenging public school districts. You'll hear highlights along with legislators' reactions. And we'll discuss the significance of the recent repeal of North Carolina's infamous MAP Act. What will that mean for property rights? What will it mean for the future of transportation in North Carolina? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
National and North Carolina Democrats are hoping that they can send Republican U.S. Senator Tom Tillis into retirement in the 2020 election, giving Democrats a crucial pickup of a seat in the United States Senate. And now, two more Democrats have said they're going to enter this race. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He joins us now with an update on the Senate race. Welcome back to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
All right, so the field of Democrats who say they would like to challenge, presumably Tom Tillis, but maybe not, and we'll talk about that. Tell us who's in.
The latest candidate as of the time we're taping this is former State Senator Eric Mansfield from Fayetteville. He is a physician. He's an ordained minister. He was in the state Senate for a couple or several terms and is someone who is would be the third African-American, I believe, on the Democratic side running for the nomination. Just before this announcement, Cal Cunningham, former state senator, who served one term, also announced it. And the thing that's interesting is that Cal Cunningham has become sort of the perennial ballot filler, if you will. He's run in several other races unsuccessfully for either the Democratic nomination or for office itself. But he looks like he's going to have the support of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is causing some consternation among some Democrats because you have three African-American candidates who have a fair amount of elective experience, and you have a one-term white Democrat male who's running who hasn't shown any success in running for statewide office, who's getting the backing of all the big money folks in Washington.
Interesting as well that there has been some reporting that Cunningham also has picked up the endorsement of former North Carolina U.S. Senator Kay Hagan.
Yes, former Senator Hagan, who's not in very good health right now,
right,
because of, I think, meningitis that she contracted right after leaving the Senate, has endorsed Cunningham. There may be an attempt by some in the state Democratic Party to clear the field of other prominent challengers. Two former state treasurers have been listed as potential candidates here, Richard Moore and his successor, Janet Cowell. Are both rumored as having interest in the race. And actually, either one of them would probably give former Senator Cunningham some problems because both of them have won statewide races more than once and also have the ability to raise money.
Have we heard anything about Deborah Ross, who ran for the U.S. Senate last time around?
She keeps being mentioned as someone who's a possibility, but we're not really sure that Cal Cunningham is the person who's going to clear the field for the other big-time Senate contenders. I believe I've seen reporting where Democrats in Washington have approached or have at least fielded interest from the Ross camp as well as certainly from Cowell and Moore. But Cunningham is the first one to come in, and it looks like if he's the eventual nominee, or if he's the eventual sort of front runner, that he would get the support of national Democrats. But again, a lot of more progressive Democrats and African American Democrats are not real happy about this situation.
Rick, based on the fact that a number of high profile names, as well as some other folks who have elective office experience, that so many folks are interested this time around, is that an indication that Tom Tillis could be vulnerable? He also could, he's got a challenge on the Republican side, but from the Democratic perspective, is Tom Tillis that vulnerable?
Well, he's perceived as vulnerable because a lot of people were very surprised that he actually won his race in 2014 against Kay Hagan. I think, as I've said on this program before, people underestimate his campaigning ability at their peril. He was a very effective campaigner. He closed very well, which Senator Hagan did not do. And so Democrats think this is going to be a good year for them. They think that President Trump running for re-election is going to be unpopular, and they think that they can pick off some of these several Senate seats in purple states, or in states where there's a closely contentious races between Democrats and Republicans. So they think Tom Tillis may be vulnerable. They also, again, may underestimate his ability as a campaigner.
Let's move to the Republican side, because he has not cleared the field. Of course, no one has filed yet at this point. But Senator Tillis presumably is running for re-election. We have every indication that he is. And he also has two people who have said they want to challenge him for the GOP nomination. We've talked about one previously. He is a businessman named Garland Tucker. But we also have Sandy Smith in this race.
A farmer about whom we really don't know a whole lot. Someone who may be running as a protest candidate, we're not sure. But not perceived right now to be a serious challenger. He could be a spoiler if it turns out that for whatever reason, Garland Tucker and Tom Tillis, I mean, nobody really takes a majority. It's possible that he could get enough votes to be a spoiler, but I think that's about all we can say right now.
Let's talk a little bit more about Tillis and Tucker. And in full disclosure for our listeners, at one point, Garland Tucker was a senior fellow at the John Locke Foundation. That relationship no longer exists, as the John Locke Foundation severed ties once it became clear and public that Garland Tucker was running for office. We are not a political organization at the John Locke Foundation. That said, Garland Tucker has been doing a lot of media, a lot of television, and really attacking Tom Tillis, saying he's not the conservative I am.
Right. Garland Tucker has been talking both about being more of a active cultural conservative than Tom Tillis, and also someone who would support President Trump's agenda more than Senator Tillis has. This is an argument that he hopes is going to hold sway among primary voters. The difficulty, I think, in the case with most people challenging Republicans at this point is that the typical Republican incumbent in the U.S. Senate has voted with President Trump about 95% of the time. So it's the few key votes may be a difference maker, but possibly not. I think where Senator Tillis has a problem of vulnerability is the fact that he did make that very public challenge of President Trump's attempt to use an emergency order to seal the border, and wrote an op-ed saying that that was not the president's responsibility, and then basically said never mind.
And changed his mind very quickly after a whole lot of criticism of that action.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit more about Trump. He is now officially in the race for re-election, and it looks like he has a pretty friendly relationship with Senator Tillis. Is an endorsement likely to come?
It may. He may well throw his weight behind Senator Tillis, especially if he thinks that Senator Tillis has a much better chance of defeating whoever the Democrats run. We've heard rumors that that's going to be the case, but we don't know that for sure yet. We know that that the grassroots group Americans for Prosperity has endorsed Tillis already. They're 501c4. So he's going to get some support, I think, from some heavy hitting conservative groups. Not clear yet about the president and what he's going to do.
because it looks like Garland Tucker's message is, I'm the person who supports President Trump. It's not Senator Tillis. So that would be a fascinating dynamic,
right,
should the president choose to endorse and choose to endorse Senator Tillis. We know for sure North Carolina battleground, as it has been for a number of years. The president's going to be here.
That's
we
right.
know.
That's
and
right.
his surrogates will be here. So it's not like he can avoid the situation.
That's right. He's going to be here. The Republican National Convention is going to be here. And so we'll be seeing a lot of the president and the people campaigning for him and for other Republicans over the next 16, 17 months.
Carolina Journal, of course, is going to be doing reporting, extensive reporting on this race. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A document called the Certificate of Need helps block innovation in North Carolina healthcare, and that's just one way in which government interventions are dampening down the healthcare innovation in North and South Carolina. Our next guest is an expert on these topics. Josh Windham is an attorney at the Institute for Justice. IJ is working on cases in both these states dealing with healthcare and government rules that block innovation. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about what's going on here in North Carolina and your case there.
Sure. So Dr. Singh is a general surgeon in Forsyth County, and last year he noticed that his patients were coming back to him whenever he would prescribe them a diagnostic scan and say, you know, Dr. Singh, I can't afford this scan, or I can't figure out what the price of this scan is. And like any good doctor who wants to serve his patients, he said, I'm going to do something about that. So he decided to open Forsyth Imaging Center, which is a full-service diagnostic center. He got an X-ray machine. He got a CT machine. He got ultrasound machines. But he found out that he was banned from getting a specific type of machine, an MRI scanner, under something called North Carolina Certificate of Need Law, which in short bans healthcare providers from acquiring new equipment or facilities unless they can prove need for those services beforehand. And often they're not even allowed to apply for a certificate of need if state planners project in advance that there's no need available for the next year.
And they need to convince state regulators that there's a need. It's not that just they prove it to their patients, prove it to potential customers. They have to convince someone within government that there's this need.
Yeah, it's sort of a two-track question because every year a bunch of central planners in Raleigh get together and release this document called the State Health Facilities Plan, which says for the next year in each what they call planning areas whether a new service is actually needed. If they don't project a need using their magic formula and their calculators and their formulas, the provider can't even apply for a con to provide those services. Now, if they do project a need, the provider still has to then file this very complex and expensive application demonstrating affirmatively that they actually meet the need requirement. So it's sort of a two-part question.
Now, you are working with Dr. Singh, who you mentioned, Dr. Gajendra Singh out of the Winston-Salem Forsyth area. Where do things stand with that case?
Yeah, so we actually filed the case in July of last year. And since then, the case has sort of been stalled a bit because it involves a facial challenge to the validity of a state statute. We have to wait until we're appointed a three-judge panel by the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court before the case can proceed. So while the government has moved to dismiss the case, there hasn't been any briefing, and we don't have a briefing schedule on that. There's a bit of an administrative backlog on this three-judge panel thing.
We are chatting with Josh Windham, who is an attorney with the Institute for Justice. You are also working on a case dealing with health care and dealing with government rules and regulations in South Carolina. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that case involves a company called Visibly. Now, when we filed the case, it was called Optrinative. But here's the basic story. Dr. Stephen Lee was a practicing optometrist who had conducted over 20,000 refractive eye tests and determined that the traditional method of getting one of these tests, of going into a brick-and-mortar optometry shop, of looking through that big clunky device with all the lenses on it and saying better or worse while you stare at that chart from the 1950s, was needlessly time-consuming and inconvenient for patients. And he said, why don't we take this same self-reporting principle at the core of these tests and with 21st century technology, allow patients to take an online test from their home? And so he actually developed software that allowed patients to do this, and in 2014 released the world's first online refractive test. And it actually works, but the problem is that when patients take that test, what are they not doing? They're not going into a brick-and-mortar optometry shop, which is how optometrists make all their money. So when the technology went live, optometrists across the country lobbied in states to get the alternative technology specifically banned, and in a few states they succeeded. So in South Carolina, they got a law passed that specifically targets and bans alternatives technology, prevents physicians from actually using that technology as part of their practices, even if it would meet the standard of care to do that, while allowing every other kind of doctor in the state to use telemedicine to treat their patients. So it singles out ophthalmologists who want to use alternatives technology.
So Institute for Justice and your client are challenging that restriction. Where does that case stand?
Yeah, so we challenged that restriction in 2016 under the South Carolina Constitution, and we're on appeal right now before the South Carolina Court of Appeals. The trial court dismissed our case at the motion for summary judgment stage, actually, after discovery, saying that we lacked standing to sue, which I think is completely incorrect and indefensible. It's one of the worst reasoned opinions I've ever read. We're looking forward to that one.
Now, we've talked about North Carolina and South Carolina. Institute for Justice works with clients really across the country.
Right.
Do we see this type of activity, the government getting involved with healthcare and blocking these innovative procedures in other states? Is this a common problem?
Yeah. I mean, just to give you one example, to go back to the con context, I mean, 34 states in D.C. have certificate of need laws of one form or another. Now, North Carolina has one of the more restrictive laws in the country, but protectionism in the medical industry is incredibly common. Basically, wherever you have professionals and large amounts of money, you're going to find people rent-seeking and working to use government power to tamp down either current or future competitors. And that's what we see all across the medical industry.
Why is this something that's so important to the Institute for Justice to deal with this type of case?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is kind of a – maybe this is a personal perspective, but the – in my view, the freedom to direct our healthcare decisions is crucial to our ability to live. I mean, my ability to work with my doctor, my doctor's freedom to recommend the treatments that are available or that he thinks I should consider trying, that relationship is very important to my ability to direct and to self-determine the course of my healthcare decisions. And when government interjects itself in that process and tells either the doctor or the patient no, people lose quality of life and they lose their lives. And too often that happens not because of a concern for patient health, but because some group was successful at lobbying legislators to protect their bottom line.
We've talked about a couple of cases in North Carolina and South Carolina that are still ongoing. North Carolina hasn't really gone very far. South Carolina, your first step was not a positive outcome. Are there other places where these rules have been challenged, health-related rules, and you've seen some successes?
Yeah, I mean, one example is in North Carolina itself. In 1973, the North Carolina Supreme Court struck down an almost identical version of North Carolina's Certificate of Need law, and our challenge is designed to replicate that in the North Carolina Supreme Court. So we're hoping and expect that that decision will be binding and control this case.
When you talk to people about these cases who are outside the legal field, outside the healthcare field, do people say, wait a minute, the government really does that?
Yeah, I think the most common response I get is sort of one of two responses. One is, like you said, what? Like, that can't be real, right? And the second one is, isn't this a free country? And my answer is, well, yes, it's real, and yes, it's a free country, but something's not adding up. Unfortunately, we have a healthcare system in North Carolina that looks too much like a Soviet-style system. But the motivation for it, I don't think, is as pernicious as the Soviet one, in the sense that you have I think it really just comes from it's sort of a different kind of motivation. It's one group thinking they can block competitors and use government power to do that. So I guess it is as pernicious as the Soviet-style system.
And others who think, whether they're right or wrong, that, hey, this is helping consumers by having the government involved.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the things that is most surprising to me about doing research for this and learning about con laws and filing this case is just sort of recognizing the kind of hubris of a central planner who thinks that they can project for an entire planning area or for the entire state what healthcare services are going to be needed.
Well, as this case and others move forward, we know that one person who's going to be playing a role and watching very closely is Josh Windham. He is an attorney at the Institute for Justice. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The State House endorsed this year a measure dubbed Allison's Law. Republican State Representative Donnie Lambeth of Forsyth County explains.
This bill actually came to me from the mom of a young lady that was in my district who had been brutally murdered, stabbed over 31 times, pulled out of her home while she was getting ready for work, three kids in the house. And the mom, as we talked about this, felt like had her daughter had some type of alert system that would alerted her that this individual had violated the restraining order and was in the area, she might have taken precautions.
Lambeth looked beyond North Carolina for ideas to address the problem.
Other states actually have a bill that actually, or a law that actually tracks and alerts individuals, and that technology now has gotten so much better that you can actually use cell phones in some cases. So this bill is, I've named it Allison's Law after the individual, the young lady who was killed. What this bill does is to give the judge a discretion if they believe that the person who has had a restraining order taken out against them is violent or may violate that restraining order, to have a tracking device, and that tracking device would alert the person who took out the restraining order, as well as the sheriff's office or protective services, and they would dispatch someone if that was a violation or they found that this individual was violating an area that the individual was not supposed to be allowed in, such as the victim's home.
Allison's Law would start out in a single North Carolina county, Forsyth.
The reason we're doing it as a pilot program is to be able to work out any of the issues with it. So we've got funds in here. I've worked with the court system, district attorney, clerk of court in Forsyth County, and they are all supportive, the sheriff's office supporting of participating in this. We also talked to the people in Randolph County who has a very successful system that works. They've had in place for a number of years, and we're going to continue to learn from what they've done in hopes that we can potentially gather enough information that we might be back at some point with a statewide bill. But this, as I mentioned, is just for Forsyth County to be able to learn more about, gather information, and put in place a tracking system that might help save lives.
One of the few questions that cropped up during debate: who pays the tab if the offender can't afford the bill?
Part of the reason to have this pilot money is to cover the cost for those who don't pay. The intent would be not to not do it because of the financial impact and use some of this money to cover that cost. And that's part of what we'll try to learn from the pilot.
That's State Representative Donnie Lambeth. He's discussing legislation dubbed Allison's Law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are looking for ways to improve education in school districts with special disadvantages. Legislative program evaluator Jeff Grimes recently noted a key finding from a report on the issue.
Most predominantly disadvantaged school districts have below grade level achievement. Those that are outperforming are typically doing so with strong performance in third grade.
That finding leads to a couple of recommendations from Grimes and the legislature's Program Evaluation Division.
The General Assembly should require low-performing school districts to include an early childhood improvement plan as a component of district improvement plans. Those districts deemed low-performing under the state's accountability system already have to create improvement plans. The evidence in our report suggests that if these struggling districts are going to increase achievement, the most likely route is by reaching a high level of achievement in the early education years. Requiring low-performing districts to have a strategy for early education improvement can help.
A second recommendation involves the state's main public education agency.
The General Assembly should require an assessment of early childhood learning as part of DPI's comprehensive needs assessment process for districts. This is an existing process that provides a systematic review of practices, processes, and systems within a district and assists district leadership in determining needs, setting priorities, and benchmarking performance. Comprehensive needs assessments can also help inform district improvement plans. Including an assessment of early childhood learning in these assessments can help ensure districts are focusing on this important time period of learning.
Republican State Representative Craig Horn responded to the new report.
What it boils down to is there's no magic bullet. We're trying lots of things. We need to continue to try lots of things. Some of them are going to work for some folks, and like everything else, some of it doesn't work for, nothing works for everyone. We need to do, to try pretty much anything we can find and see, because some things are going to work for others. Certainly in the report, I call the preparation gap. Kids that are not prepared to start kindergarten for all kinds of reasons. Some of them are family issues. Some of them are academic issues. Some of them are physical or medical issues. But under any circumstances, we need to reach out to these kids and their families and do everything we can.
Horn reminded colleagues that the state budget addresses these issues in some ways.
Baked into the budget are some 3,400 additional slots over the next 2 years for NC Pre-K. That's not enough. It's not going to cover all the kids that are potentially eligible. And all the kids that are potentially eligible aren't going to have access. So there's a lot of things we have to look at. But no question that when we've got kids that have heard 30 million more words by the time they're 5 years old than other kids, we're going to have a preparation gap. And we, as a state, as parents, grandparents, as legislators, we've got to find a way to address that. We cannot, with all due respect to farmhands, we cannot be raising a generation of farmhands. We've got to provide opportunities for every child to be prepared when they begin school.
State Representative Rena Turner asked the evaluator, Grimes, what his research has found about successful disadvantaged students.
Is there any enlightenment from the data that would say what motivated those students in disadvantaged areas that performed highly?
One of the common themes I think that emerged was talking to the superintendents, they would say, well, we've got a lot of poverty in our school district, but everybody in this district believes that these kids can learn and succeed. And so I do think that that is an important important piece. If the school district, you know, from the beginning doesn't think that the kids are likely to succeed, it's probably a good chance they won't.
Democratic State Senator Don Davis asked about the existing plans targeted by Grimes' recommendations.
Looking at the district improvement plans, are there any indications, how are the school districts, LEAs, actually addressing this or not right now? If we're talking about more legislation that provides, more of a reporting requirement. My question is, have we actually evaluated the plans that are coming forth that are being produced at this point?
That is an existing process. We did not specifically evaluate the overall effectiveness of the district improvement plan process. The idea behind recommendation one is basically that since we know this early period is so important, making sure that that's being looked at in their plans, our feeling with this recommendation is that having districts plan and look at early childhood can certainly help.
Republican State Senator Chuck Edwards also asked about the plans.
It almost seems to me like we're saying that if you have an underperforming school system, then, or at least in regards to early childhood education, then you should put together a plan to fix that. I mean, which seems fairly obvious. I just would have expected a bit more granularity into a plan.
Republican Senator Andy Wells turned his colleagues' attention back to the report itself.
I'd like to keep us focused on some really good information in this report. Finding three, economic disadvantaged districts that perform well share common characteristics, and you've got six pages exploring those half dozen or so characteristics that they have in common. It says, although commonalities exist among the 12 case study districts, they did not use identical strategies and approaches. So there's no master plan that state government can come up with and fix this problem. There are a number of steps that you can take, but it seems to me from reading this report that the most important one is that you take the care to have a plan, not the plan. And that plan, you've got a half dozen things that may or may not need to be included in that plan. But I think just focusing an administration, a school board, a community on this specific pre-K, and I agree with Superintendent Johnson, pre-K through three, that just focusing energy on that is kind of like sharpening your saw. And you can go out in the woods and cut down a few trees with a dull saw. It's not a lot of fun, and you look like a fool to anybody watching. If you take a little time to put an edge on, a precise edge, you can get a whole lot more done. And I think this whole process about creating a plan, an individual plan by LEA, not a state master plan, is a key to this. They need to have a plan. LEAs, you figure out what that plan needs to be. Talk to these folks that are doing it well, and some of these demographics are depressing. Jones County, 83% free and reduced lunch. But they made the good list. So anybody can make a good list if they have a plan and execute it.
You've been listening to highlights from legislative debate about improving student performance in North Carolina's most disadvantaged school districts. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It is called the MAP Act, one of the most anti-property rights laws on the books in North Carolina. But with Governor Roy Cooper's signature on a recently passed bill, the MAP Act would be gone. It's a move long endorsed by our next guest, John Guzet, who is Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna. Glad to be here.
This law, the MAP Act, has been on the books in North Carolina for 30 years or so. What is it, and why are you and others so upset about it?
Well, the MAP Act empowered the Department of Transportation and other agencies and organizations as well, but primarily the Department of Transportation to impose permanent moratoria on development within designated transportation corridors. The idea was that since they knew they were going to build a road there eventually, it would be a bad thing for any new development to take place. The problem is these things sat on the books for years, sometimes for decades. The owners weren't allowed to develop the land in any way, sometimes not even doing so much as build a carport. And it went on year after year without any compensation.
Let me make sure I understand. So if the state of North Carolina determined that they wanted to build a road, say, in an area where I owned a house, they could say you can't do anything to the house, including sell it. knowing that you could end up being in a situation where they were going to take your property?
No, you could sell it, but it'd be jolly hard to sell it.
Who would want to buy it?
Because
right?
You can't do anything with it.
So you have been writing about this for a number of years, about instances where people in different areas of the state have been ensnared by the MAP Act, and some of those people ended up suing.
They did. There was a group of landowners in Forsyth County that owned property in a series of corridors around Winston-Salem, and they got together and they sued the Department of Transportation demanding compensation. They said that imposing a permanent moratorium on development was equivalent to a taking under the Law of the Land Clause of the North Carolina Constitution, and they should be compensated.
What happened?
Well, it went up through the courts. It took a long time, but eventually it made it all the way to the North Carolina Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, this is a taking. You have to compensate these people. That's what they said to the Department of Transportation.
Tell us a little bit more about the Supreme Court's reasoning on that, because I'm sure they took into account that the state and the Department of Transportation would need to build certain infrastructure, and there would be a way to go about that. So what did the Supreme Court, how did it kind of look at the rights of property owners versus the state?
Well, there is no question that the state has the power of eminent domain. They could take land if they need it for a road. But under our Constitution, they have to compensate the owners. The Supreme Court said, and they were following the same line of reasoning that the Court of Appeals had used before, this is being done because they want to reduce what they ultimately have to pay for the land. They want to prevent development because development adds to the value. This is a way to get the land on the cheap. That's not acceptable. These people, if you're going to take away the right to develop the land, you're taking away a valuable portion of their property rights. You have to compensate them.
Now, with this Supreme Court ruling, I would suspect the folks in Forsyth County and other people in different parts of the states who also found themselves in limbo because of the MAP Act would have been cheering, saying, yay, we won. Did it turn out that way?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they are winning. They did win, and they are winning, but the Department of Transportation did drag its heels for a long time about paying the actual compensation. There were many subsequent lawsuits over the value of the property and so on and so forth, but payments are going out, and slowly but surely, those landowners are getting compensated.
Now that we had the Supreme Court ruling, then why did the General Assembly get involved, and why are we now here today talking about a bill that would essentially remove the MAP Act from law with Governor Roy Cooper's signature?
Well, in effect, the Supreme Court's decision made the MAP Act a dead letter. They weren't going to be able to, if they were going to use that MAP Act to impose transportation corridors in the future, they were going to have to compensate the owners. And so they weren't probably likely to do that. Nevertheless, the legislature acted immediately to impose a moratorium on new corridors right after that Supreme Court decision, and they asked the Department of Transportation to do a study and come back with recommendations on what an alternative way of planning for future transportation needs might be. They waited and waited, but that moratorium would have ended this summer, so they decided a time had come. They just simply repealed the MAP Act. The Department of Transportation did eventually provide a report. It was a few months late, but they did it. And so the next step in this process will be for the legislature to look at that report, digest it, decide what, if anything, they want to put in place as an alternative.
John, with a state Supreme Court ruling essentially saying that this is unfair, how the MAP Act has been imposed in North Carolina, could the legislature have simply just let the law stay enacted? Would there have been a way for the Department of Transportation to go ahead and impose it, or would that Supreme Court ruling prevail? I guess what I'm getting at is it necessary to actually repeal it?
No, it's not necessary. There are plenty of statutes still on the books that aren't enforceable, but it's better government to get rid of it, and especially because we need a way to plan for the future as far as our transportation needs are concerned. If the MAP Act is going to be unusable because of the cost, or the result of the MAP Act decision was that simply designating land as transportation corridors wasn't going to be a way to get that land eventually cheaply. So if they want to have some way to control how land gets developed going forward, they need to come up with a better system.
Yeah, and speaking of a better system, let's talk a bit about that, because certainly roads have to be built. bridges have to be built. The Department of Transportation is in charge of implementing that kind of infrastructure activity in the state. So what are your thoughts on what would be the best approach so that property rights are rightly protected, but yet infrastructure has to be built?
Well, there's probably not any perfect solution, because as soon as the state makes it known that they have plans to use some property in the future, that in and of itself is going to have a negative impact on the value of the land. That's just probably the price we pay for living in a changing, in a state that's growing with changing transportation needs. I actually like the approach that the Department of Transportation came back with in their report. They said, look, the best way for us to deal with these future transportation needs is to acquire the land as soon as we know we need it. But they also said to the state legislature, you're going to have to give us the money to do it, because obviously under state law and the state constitution, we'll have to compensate the owners.
Yeah. And so if you are an owner who finds yourself in that position, I guess you could say the earlier you know, the better, because then you're going to have to quickly determine what your options are. And now compensation and fast compensation is a requirement.
Yes. Well, compensation is certainly going to be a requirement. How fast it will be will depend on how willing the Department of Transportation is to come to terms with landowners. This can be a long process simply if it gets into the courts. But yes, that's the way it has to be done. And at least that's the way I hope it will be done.
John, people might be listening to us and thinking this is unthinkable, that government would come in and essentially depress the value of your land, limit your ability to make upgrades, et cetera, and decrease the market value. They just might be surprised that this has indeed been happening.
Well, they may be surprised, but if they're surprised, it's because they don't really know what goes on. It's been happening in this state. It's been happening in other parts of the country. And it's not just when it comes to transportation planning. We could get into some other topics like eminent domain. People have to be vigilant, because property rights are always at risk.
John is Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Thanks for giving us an update on the MAP Act, John. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Donna.
And that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.